and gentlemen. First case for argument, Girl Scouts of Manitou. Mr. Ladig?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I am Gary Ladig, here for Manitou Council. Your Honor, obviously the First Amendment expressive association issue has risen to the top and certainly has consumed most of the ink in this case. I'm of the opinion this is not a First Amendment case, and that it has really distracted from, I think, more important issues with regard to the common law and statutory claims. But because clearly Judge Stottmuller at the district court based his opinion heavily upon his conclusion that there was a violation of the First Amendment, I will address it, but I hope to give myself enough time to move on to what I think are extremely important issues under some of the remaining counts. As I said, I don't think this is a First Amendment case because it seems to me this is, in what both the district court and GSUSA failed to acknowledge, this is a matter arising out of a pre-existing consensual commercial contract between two parties. In all of the cases, whether they be political party cases or forced inclusion cases, you had a situation where you had an outsider, someone who did not have the pre-existing relationship with the entity and was trying to wedge his or her way in through enforcement of a piece of state legislation. That completely contextually removes this case from those cases. This would have been a completely different case, for example, in Boy Scouts v. Dale, if Mr. Dale was an officer of Boy Scouts and had an employment contract, and he felt he was being terminated in violation of an employment contract. This would be a completely different situation that's the difference. And it helps me when I'm analyzing cases to analogize it to something else. But it seems to me this case would be no different than if Girl Scouts came to the conclusion that their headquarters in New York were so antiquated and so far behind the times with regard to their communications, their office equipment, the look of the place you walked in, it was awful, it scared donors away. They decided they needed to gut the building and refurbish it. And their goal was, by doing that, to greatly enhance their voice, to greatly enhance their ability to get the word out on Girl Scouting and to be a more effective association. That may all be well and true, but if they had pre-existing contracts with their furniture vendors or with their telephone vendor or with their computer vendors, they couldn't call that individual up or that company and say, "We're reorganizing. We're going to do it a different way with a different system. We're not going to pay you anymore." And it's our First Amendment right to do that. Similarly, if they went ahead with the construction, they would have to obey the city's zoning laws, building regulations. They'd have to continue to pay their employees in accordance with labor laws. If it's a union building, they'd have to bring in union workers. They happen to own, I believe it's a condominium building in Manhattan that they have several floors in, so they would have to obey the rules and regulations of their condominium association. If they violated those rules and regulations, the association could come in on a forcible detainer or some other statutory action to evict them, and the Girl Scouts could not hold up the First Amendment and say, "Well, you can't evict us. We're doing this reorganization to further our message, to further our voice." I don't see this case as being not only not markedly different, but not different than those situations. We have a contract. This court has already determined it has all of the earmarks of and is a dealership agreement under the Wisconsin Fair Dealership Law. And accordingly, Girl Scouts must obey that law. To the extent they claim it is somehow interfering with their voice, with their expression, we have yet to hear how. Manitou Council is, by all acknowledgments, a highly performing council. It has nearly double the market share of their national averages. It attends to all girls throughout its jurisdiction. It's not violating a single one of its contractual obligations, because if it were, it could be tossed out for violation of its obligations, and they're very detailed obligations. And that's what's so nice about the WFDL. It is entirely viewpoint neutral. The WFDL could care less what the grantor's product is, what the grantor's service is that it wants to hawk and sell in the state of Wisconsin. All the WFDL says is if you're going to come into Wisconsin and sell your product or your services, number one, you don't have to do it in a dealership mode. You can do it any way you want. But if you're going to do it in a dealership mode, and that's GSUSA's choice, then you have to follow these rules. And one of those rules is you have to be fair and reasonable, and you have to have good cause when you terminate a dealer.
Isn't a good cause issue a question of fact, raise questions of fact?
It does. And in this case, there are no factual issues on it. There are two types of good cause here, Your Honor. One is the statutorily clearly expressed language, which is contingent upon a dealer doing something wrong. And when the dealer is doing something outside of his dealership agreement, the statute requires a notice, putting him on notice of it, and a cure period. That is not in play here. GSUSA does not claim it has that kind of good cause. The Wisconsin Supreme Court went beyond the statute and really very, of claims of judicial activism, this would be one, where it really created a new concept of good cause beyond the statute and said in a very limited situation where a manufacturer, or rather a grantor, has significant economic harm to it, it can, and if as a result of that harm, it's going to change the way it does business within the state, then that may rise to the level of good cause.
Well, isn't that really what the Girl Scouts have alleged?
They've tried to allege it. They have not. They do not profess to claim that they have met the Ziegler, which is the Wisconsin Supreme Court's case standard of showing any economic mandate or economic problem here that's resulting in this call. What they're saying is that there's a non-economic reason this need to get their voice out to reorganize as an association.
Well, there's the reference to underserved and diversity and that sort of First Amendment issues, but is there anything in the record itself apart from Judge Stadmuller's opinion that talks about that?
I would say no. Basically, GSUSA just keeps saying over and over again they had this vision, they saw reorganization as a means by which they could get to more people, be more effective. But here's the step that I think the district court missed, and I think this is important when Your Honors address the WFDL. Before you even get to the Ziegler so-called grantor-based good cause, you don't even get to whether or not there's such a serious situation that the grantor needs to do anything. First you say, well, is the grantor really changing the way it's marketing? So, for example, where grantor-based good cause has come into play in the past, the manufacturer has eliminated all of its dealers who were buying at wholesale and selling at retail, had their own inventories, had their own exposure, and converted them to simple sales reps working on commission. That's the Ziegler case. In one of this court's cases, Morley Murphy, the manufacturer removed the entire middle tier of dealers and took it all in-house, a complete sea change in how it was going to market. Another example would be where the situation is so serious, the manufacturer withdraws entirely from the market. Here, Girl Scouts has not changed anything. They still are going to market exactly as they always have, through councils, with using the exact same charter, the exact same application for charter, the exact same blue book set of rules and regulations. The only thing that's changed is who they want to be their council. It's absolutely no difference in my practice when I'm dealing with normal manufacturing type dealers. Manufacturers are constantly trying to shift and rearrange who their dealership network is. They may have a state with six dealers, and they say, no, you know, we really think we only need one for that state.
Did the court rule in favor of you on a violation of the Wisconsin Fair Dealer Act?
I think so, Your Honor, and but I, so
well,
I don't
think so. It said it, didn't it?
Well, yes, but I don't want to.
What's the ambiguity?
Say that again. I'm sorry.
What's the ambiguity? I don't understand.
I'm not finding an ambiguity. I wanted to make sure I answered Judge Kenney's answer or question fully, and I think in this situation, and
okay, well, why don't you say the rest of your time?
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Treader.
May it please the Court, I'm Lyndon Treader from the Hogan Lovells Law Firm, and I have the privilege to represent Girl Scouts of the United States of America. The Girl Scouts' determination of its council's jurisdictions is an expression of its associational message and is protected by the First Amendment.
What is the infringement of the First Amendment here? I don't understand that at all.
Well, Your Honor, we operate a federated system, and there's no question that we're an expressive association.
Well, are you challenging the constitutionality of the Wisconsin Fair Dealer Act?
As applied, yes.
So it can't. So the Wisconsin Fair Dealer Act can't be applied to what? Bookstores, newspapers, television stations?
Well, of course not, Your Honor.
Of course not. Why? They're engaged in expressive activities.
They are not expressive. I don't think a bookstore, Borders Bookstore, is an expressive association. A literary society might be.
Why do you say that? There are all sorts of bookstores that, you know, special interest, communist bookstores, goodness knows what. They often have a slant.
It's possible.
And look at the media, Fox or what have you.
Your Honor, I think it's...
What if Fox makes deals with radio stations in Wisconsin?
They're acting.
They can't be. They're not subject to the ordinary contract rules. And
I mean,
I thought your opponent's first example was very telling.
Which example is that?
All these media companies are subject to the ordinary tort and contract and regulatory provisions and so on, unless, of course, these are regulatory provisions that somehow curtail speech by these organizations.
Exactly, Your Honor, and that's the speech is informed by the way you organize yourself.
No, that's much too broad.
I don't think it is too broad, Your Honor.
Well,
the Supreme Court has said in
there would be a case that would support your extravagant view of the First Amendment.
Well, let's. I think the main case.
By the way, there's something that disturbs me very much in your brief. I'm looking at page 31 of your brief.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm with you. And that's the case I would cite, is the U case. I think it's the most important case for you to read.
Yes, and what you did was you substitute the word group for the word party.
Correct.
That's fraud.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I don't think there's
that is extremely improper, because anybody who reads this and doesn't go back to the original opinion is going to think that the court was talking about groups in general. It was talking about a party, a political party.
Right.
Now, you could argue that the logic of their reasoning extends beyond political parties, but that's what they're talking about. You mustn't substitute language in a quotation.
Your Honor, I don't think that we...
You mustn't do that.
Well, I apologize if Your Honor was misled. I don't think...
That is extremely improper, because judges don't read every single opinion that's cited in a brief.
I apologize if Your Honor thinks we were misleading. We were not trying to mislead. I think we dealt with you as strictly a political party case. But I think that the political party cases say a lot about this case. In you, the restriction...
This is not a political party. And I don't understand that...
Your Honor,
reach,
I don't think...
I don't understand the reach of your argument, whether you think that all media companies, that any firm that has an expressive function which every firm does. Firms engaged in marketing, and
Your Honor,
commercial speech is protected by the First Amendment.
If I may. First, the limiting principle is that the association has to be primarily for the purposes of advocating a particular viewpoint. Now, it doesn't have to be...
That certainly describes any company. It advocates for its products.
Yes, that's true, but that's in the nature of commercial speech. This
commercial
is not in...
Commercial speech is protected by the First Amendment.
It is. It doesn't deserve the same degree of protection as the Girl Scouts or the Boy Scouts, which this court...
Is political speech?
No. To quote from Abood versus Board of Education, which is a United States Supreme Court case, which involved whether a state law could compel a teacher to contribute to a municipal union. Nothing in the First Amendment or our cases discussing its meaning makes the question of whether the adjective political can properly be attached to those beliefs the critical constitutional question. The Girl Scouts are entitled to the same protection as the Democratic Party of the United States. And in the U case, Your Honor, the nature of the burden there was the California wanted to say, we want you to rotate your committee chairman between North and South California. We want your committee chairman to have certain terms of office. And the United States Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. It didn't have anything to do with the fact that they are a political party. It was a regulation on the association qua association. The political party cases are in there.
You don't see any difference between that and this case?
I don't. For the purposes, political parties play a very important role in things like primaries and general elections. They're also associations that have their own conventions. And in the cases that involve their own conventions, and Mr. Leidig was talking about, we don't see any disputes between the organization.
The political party, it's choosing candidates, it's creating a platform, and clearly to say that, you know, they have to rotate from north to south and so on, obviously that interferes greatly with the selection of their candidates and the drafting of their platform. Here, what concretely happens to girls, your organization's expressive activity if it complies with the Wisconsin Fair Dealer Law?
We're stuck with islands. In other words, it's very easy to be a high-performing council when you're in a nice suburban area where you have lots of two-parent families, where there are plenty of volunteers.
Well, your opponent says that you don't actually there is no actual evidence concerning this notion that, you know, these are these elite suburban areas.
There is plenty of evidence, Your Honor, and it's in the actual, if I could read you or cite to you from our supplemental appendix, particular pages, where SSA, this is our separate supplemental appendix, 120.
Did the district judge make findings?
The district judge didn't make findings, and he cited to our findings, which were based entirely on the record. And these documents are in the record.
So he cited these documents?
Absolutely. SSA 120, where Manitou itself, remember that what happened here is Manitou was going to merge.
He cited in his opinion.
I don't know if he cites to a particular page.
That's
SSA
what I asked you. Does he cite to your documents?
He cites.
And you said yes.
He cites to our proposed findings of fact throughout his opinion, Your Honor.
That's evidence?
Our proposed findings of fact, if Your Honor goes into the record, and I understand this court can't be burdened with that, but is based on deposition transcripts, documents in the record. We have done our supplemental appendix. I would cite the court to SSA 45 through 80, which talks in painstaking detail about why Girl Scouts of the United States of America thought it was necessary to do this reorganization of its councils. We are like a brain. We're in charge, entrusted by a congressional charter to instill certain values in girls. We are the premier leadership organization for girls in the United States. And our charter says that as the head, the corporation, GSUSA, is to direct and coordinate the Girl Scout movement in the United States. The way we do that, the arms and legs of our movement, are the councils. We're like the judiciary. We can't go out and enforce our orders. We have to act through people. And what we do is we act through councils. They're the ones that actually implement our program. We have these pathways called troops and non-troops. And, Your Honor, if you're going to determine that any state could interfere with the jurisdiction that we have over our councils, well, then you're going to interfere with our way of delivering our message.
By diminishing the territories for Manitou, you could ultimately acquire the real property they have, can't you?
Not true, Your Honor.
Default back to GSUSA?
No, the transfer was going to go to other councils. And the whole point of this, keep
in mind.
So
you direct the properties to the other council?
The first idea was a merger. And in any merger, what happens is the properties are consolidated in the surviving entity. I mean, Manitou could have actually been the surviving corporate entity. Wouldn't have been a problem. And all of the assets of the other councils would have been merged into it. GSUSA has absolutely no financial interest in either in the realignment. I mean, one thing that Mr. Leidig likes to make a point of, I don't know how relevant it is that we were not taking over any of the assets. We were not changing the fundamental relationship of a federated system. We might have done that, and I'd like to know what the court might say. Well, gee, now what are you doing? Is that important to your message? I got to believe there would be a First Amendment right if we thought for some reason that the whole council system was failing, that we had to scrap it and go to developing our own employees who can implement our program. But to go to your question, Your Honor, there is no taking by the national organization of any of the assets of any of the councils. And that was part of the district court's decision on the breach of fiduciary duty. And the testimony of the Manitou people was they didn't think we were operating out of financial concerns.
Would you indicate where in the record that the district judge said, first, the Girl Scouts' efforts to provide programs to unserved or underserved communities, such as inner-city youth, presented severe challenges to Girl Scouts of America? How did that happen in this council?
How did that happen?
How was Manitou not be able to provide to unserved or underserved communities such as inner-city youths? They didn't have any inner-city youths?
They didn't. No, they did not. That was...
So the idea is then to expand them so you give them inner-city youths.
Well, the idea was to cross-fertilize councils, absolutely, on a socioeconomic basis.
By moving them north and including Michigan?
Rural. Yes, absolutely, Your Honor.
Seven counties. Right.
That is correct, Your Honor.
That's part of suburban Milwaukee.
No, the idea was suburban Milwaukee would.
No, they did have it. That was the way it was originally.
They did originally have it, but in the original merger program, part of Manitou was going north, part of Manitou was going south. The suburban counties, like Osaki County, was to go to the Milwaukee Council. So, Osaki was not going to originally come to the north.
But the inner city, say, in Milwaukee was already served by a council, right?
Yes. But the whole point of these councils was to make bigger councils. We had islands, basically, of suburban councils that were doing very well. And maybe you disagree with the idea of sharing resources and spreading the wealth, but it was very important to Girl Scouts of the United States of America to create councils where the economically strong councils were floating the boats of the lesser strong councils.
So I guess I'll go back to where are those facts?
I would cite, as I said, Your Honor, we tried to put a number of the documents that the district court was also relying on in our separate supplemental appendix. And this is separate supplemental appendix 45 through 80.
How do we know what the district court was relying on?
I agree, Your Honor, that the district court could have been done more pin-sighting. There are a number of times where we tried to incorporate our brief, and I would cite the panel to our brief where we both cite the district court opinion, an A cite, as well as either a supplemental separate appendix cite and a record cite.
Aren't there questions of fact?
I think on the good cause, I mean, there's a real dilemma here, Your Honor. You have a statute where Theoretically.
I don't think you've preserved that issue.
Good, on good cause?
Continuing with, I think your brief is dishonest. You say that the district judge ruled for you on all counts.
That is correct.
But of course, the district court thought that you'd violated the Wisconsin Fair Dealer Law were it not for your First Amendment defense.
Correct,
now,
Your Honor.
In your brief, you try to challenge that and say even without the First Amendment, you didn't violate it. But you don't state that in your issues.
I believe we do, Your Honor. I believe we say that that's an alternate ground for affirmance here.
That's not in your statement of the issues presented by the appeal. That's another part of your brief.
I believe it's in the statement of issues, Your Honor. You're right, Your Honor. It's not. It's. We asked to certify the question.
Suppose the New York Times said, you know, the minimum wage in Illinois is so high, we're really having trouble distributing our newspapers. And therefore, the minimum wage is unconstitutional as applied to us. Is that a good argument?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Well, I think that there are various time, place, and manner restrictions. It wouldn't be a substantial burden.
What are you talking about?
Well,
time, place, and manner. That's nothing to do with anything. The New York Times is arguing, let's say truthfully, that because of high minimum wage for their delivery people, it's there. You know, it's difficult. They have to curtail their distribution. They're not able to reach everybody. You know, they have to cut the thin roots. Now, is that why isn't that the same sort of argument you're making?
Well, the New York Times has First Amendment rights. It's not an expressive association. I don't believe it is.
Wait a second. Now I'm totally baffled. The New York Times is more expressive than the Girl Scouts. And the question is, can these expressive organizations challenge laws of general applicability on the ground that if the laws did not apply to them, they'd have more expressive activity because their costs would be lower?
I do not think that that's the principle. The principle is it has to substantially burden their expression.
Well, I'm saying substantially burdens because maybe they can't afford now to distribute the newspaper to 5% of their subscribers in Illinois.
If it were, Your Honor, I think if the answer, because I see my time is over, I'm going to answer your question. I think, personally, that if the New York Times can find no other way and that there is a question about whether the press can actually deliver its message into a particular jurisdiction because of a neutral regulation, there are First Amendment concerns with that.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Lady. Mr. Treader?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honors, a couple points that, that were just raised. I think the fallacy of the First Amendment argument is highlighted by the kind of tactical maneuvering that GSUSA did in connection with this lawsuit. As you know from the facts, they did not go through, once we filed our lawsuit, they did not go through with the complete reassignment and realignment of our counsel. Instead, they constantly represented to both the district court and to this court in the prior appeal that we're only going to move 60% north and Manitou will be free to be a counsel and free to do what it wants to do in the remaining 40%. I submit that was a tactical move to avoid my argument that we were being terminated. And they could now say, oh, they're not being terminated. That tactic has backfired on them because if we are violating their First Amendment rights by being in the 60% that they moved, why are we not violating their First Amendment rights in the 40% that they have retained us in? To me, it's like as if in the Dale Boy Scout case, they told Mr. Dale, the scoutmaster, it's okay if you continue to be a homosexual scoutmaster contrary to our policy with 40 of the 100 boys you work with, but you can only not talk with 60 of those 100 boys. There's a complete disconnect there. And that's why I think, and I perhaps it was awfully strong, but I think the First Amendment argument is a sham. And as a commercial litigator who rarely gets involved in First Amendment arguments, I think of the First Amendment somewhere way up here and not something to be used as a litigation tool. And I see this case where the First Amendment is being used as a litigation tool and not as a result of any fundamental belief by them that they're being harmed. And I think that is heightened also by the footnote, solely a tiny little footnote reference in the first appeal to this whole First Amendment issue. If they really were of the opinion that their First Amendment associational rights were being violated, it would have risen right to the top in the first appeal. It did not. One of your honors asked about this question about the real estate transfer. This is one of those common law issues I wanted to make sure I hit upon. This is very, very important. It's our last count of our complaint. It's the breach of fiduciary duty claim. And I want to make sure your honors understand, we are not claiming that there is just generically or inherently in a grantor-dealer relationship a fiduciary duty. The facts of this case, though, compel that because as a condition precedent to being a Girl Scout counsel, you must establish your articles of incorporation in such a way that you are exclusively a Girl Scout counsel and that upon dissolution or ceasing to do business, you will cause all of your assets to revert to Girl Scouts or to a Girl Scout designee counsel. And that's in large part when just it's a good practice. You want this stuff to stay internal, but it's also obligation of a 501c3 not-for-profit. You have to make sure your assets move from one 501c3 tax-exempt nonprofit to another 501c3 tax-exempt. Our breach of fiduciary duty says, well, okay, if you're going to compel us to set up our corporation that way, and you put yourself out there as the ultimate beneficiary of millions of dollars of our assets, that's okay as long as you're not the one causing us to dissolve. If you're doing things to cause us to go out of business, you have abused the place of trust that we have given to you, and that is a breach of fiduciary duty. That's the nature of our claim. The judge, the district court judge, I believe he had a couple bases for tossing out my claim. I think the principal one, however, was he felt that Girl Scouts was justified in doing what they were doing, again, harking back to the fact that they were an expressive association. They weren't violating the WFDL, and they had a right to be doing what they were doing. To your question, Your Honor, and both you, even Judge Posner, when you said, well, hasn't the WFDL been decided? Yes. But the reason it loops back to the First Amendment, if I could just finish my thought.
Sure.
Thank you. Is that what I wanted to show is the WFDL is content neutral, and Girl Scouts is fully at liberty if my counsel were to go off message, if they were to say girls are bad, if they were not to do the Girl Scout program, if they were not to sell Girl Scout products, they could be instantly, under the statutory definition of good cause, be terminated. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you very much, both counsel.